Thanks, Diana, and thank you, Anselm, for inviting me. I'm really happy to be here and to be able to contribute something to this, I think, totally amazing exhibition. Oh, one thing I should say, one change from the advertised talk, I'm not really going to speak about Tom McCarthy's remainder, but maybe I'll speak about it a bit in the Q&A if people want me to. In considering the relationship between quantified life and sociality, my thoughts turn not only to computation, but also to capital. While it's incredibly useful to track the intensifying relationship between quantification and sociality from Edward Meyerbridge and Etienne Jules Marais' experiments in motion capture through the industrial efficiency projects of Frederick Winslow Taylor and Frank and Lillian Gilbreth, and into the complex of financialization algorithms and precarious labor that characterizes the so-called post-industrial economy, I think that it's important to also place these developments upon a longer history, what Frederick Jameson calls the uninterrupted narrative of capitalist accumulation and its concomitant social formations. Might we admit that Marx remains one of the preeminent theorists of the quantification of sociality? Consider, for example, this famous passage from Volume 1 of Capital. Here, Marx considers what happens through the processes in which matter and activity become crystallized or congealed in the commodity form. So Marx writes, "If we make abstraction from its use value, we make abstraction at the same time from the material elements and shapes that make the product a use value. We see in it no longer a table, a house, yarn, or any other useful thing. Its existence as a material thing is put out of sight. Neither can it any longer be regarded as the product of the labor of the joiner, the mason, the spinner, or any other definite kind of productive labor. Along with the useful qualities of the products themselves, we put out of sight both the useful character of the various kinds of labor embodied in them and the concrete forms of that labor. There is nothing left but what is common to them all, reduced to one and the same sort of labor, human labor in the abstract. In the process of a value production, in which human activity and materials are equally reduced to numeric values, all that is concrete or sensuous disappears. All that remains is a web of values on a single scale, ready for exchange. This is why, for Marx, the human worker caught in circuits of exchange is reduced to what he calls a dot-like isolation, punctualitat. From this point of view, the world of bodies and objects already looks like a cybernetic system. Might we then understand capitalism itself as a form of computation and the capture of the concrete and the sensuous as one of the preconditions for such a system? This appears to be what Gayatri Spivak is suggesting when she writes, according to Marx, under capitalism, value as produced in necessary and surplus labor is computed as the representation and sign of objectified labor, which is rigorously distinguished from human activity. Two things strike me as especially important here. The first is the use of computation to describe a technical process through which human activity becomes quantified as value in a specific way, but which has no necessary connection to computing machinery as such. And the second is the parenthetical reminder that objectified labor is radically different from human activity in general. In transforming the latter into the former, something is lost. The processing of human activity into surplus value is not, however, the only register at which human life is quantified under capitalism, as this passage from the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass ought to remind us. So here the narrator is sent from Baltimore to Tuckahoe, Maryland, in order to be recorded as a cash value because his master has died unexpectedly without leaving a will. And Douglass writes, "We were all ranked together at the valuation. Men and women, old and young, married and single, were ranked with horses, sheep, and swine. There were horses and men, cattle and women, pigs and children, all holding the same rank in the scale of being, and were all subject to the same narrow examination. Silvery-headed age and sprightly youth, maids and matrons had to undergo the same indelicate inspection. At this moment, I saw more clearly than ever the brutalizing effects of slavery." This passage clarifies the way in which capitalism does not simply imply a single monolithic approach for computing life as value. There are protocols for extracting value from life defined as human and productive, and there are protocols for extracting value from bodies of those defined as non-human and non-productive. For the former, it is activity or interaction that generates value. For the latter, which is exemplified by slavery and its ongoing legacies, the person is reduced to a resource to be bought and sold or acted upon. Critically, those people and things that are excluded from networks of activity-based value formation and exchange are not accidental byproducts or elements external to capital as such. They are the very precondition for capitalist accumulation in general. So while it's important to think through the ways in which aesthetic works register and critique systems of quantification as they operate in economy and governance, we should also be attentive to the ways in which such arrangements operate through exclusion and suspension, as well as through inclusion and representation. So I'll say more about this later, but for now I want to think about the ways in which relationships between technology and aesthetic production can help us to think through the complex of capital, computation, exploitation, and exclusion. On November 13, 1947, the engineer Frank Gray filed a patent for what would come to be called Gray Code, a method of coding numbers that was optimized for a representation by arrangements of open or closed electromechanical switches. Essentially, Gray Code differs from regular binary because each integer differs from its immediate predecessor by only one digit, one move of one digit. So Gray opens his patent by foregrounding a problem that he sees in regular binary. It is a characteristic of the conventional binary number notation, he writes, that a value change of unity may be reflected in the binary number notation by a simultaneous change in several of the digits. Thus, for example, with four digits, the number 7 is represented by 0, 1, 1, 1, while the next number, 8, is represented by 1, 0, 0, 0. In the course of changing the value by one unit, each of the four digits has been changed. And following this, Gray posits an alternative system that looks like this. So the point is that there's only a single change in each successive number. So for example, in regular binary, the number 2 would be represented 0, 1, 0, but the number 1, 0, 0, 1. So you have to change two columns to change from 1 to 2. Gray's reorganization of binary around the minimal number of changes from number to number foregrounds the premise that Gray code is a system of counting designed with the materiality of computing machines in mind. The gap between abstract logic and its concrete computation by machines was a subject of enormous debates in the 1940s and 1950s, not least at the Macy conferences that Anna mentioned, that took place in New York between 1946 and 1952. This gap, the gap between abstract logic and kind of machined logic, is summed up by John von Neumann when he states in a 1952 lecture at the California Institute of Technology titled Probabilistic Logic and the Synthesis of Reliable Organisms from Unreliable Components that there is one important difference between ordinary logic and the automata which represent it. Time never occurs in logic, but every network or nervous system has a definite time lag between the input signal and the output response. A definite temporal sequence is always inherent in the operation of such a real system. And around the same time, von Neumann described the nervous system as an analog system that could be represented digitally. He also suggested that all real phenomena are continuous and that the digital is nothing more than a human conceptual frame applied to some of these continuous phenomena. This is in the conversation following one of the talks at the 6th Macy conference. Because electronic machine computation is premised on a real system, it requires the movement of components that, due to their materiality, cannot be assumed to perfectly synchronize even when triggered by the same input. In such a system, avoiding the need for simultaneous switching dramatically reduces the possibility of errors. In other words, grey code functions to ameliorate the possibility of accidents resulting from the difference between the abstract logic that computation is often taken to exemplify and the materiality of the machines that make this so-called abstract logic concretely possible. Appropriately, another name given to this type of code, the grey type code, in the 1950s was the minimum error code. By the 1990s, a specific variation of grey code had been added to computer science manuals. Titled the Beckett Grey Code, this variant was named for a combination of Frank Gray's name and that of the novelist, poet, and playwright Samuel Beckett. So Beckett Grey Codes are designed to process first-in, last-out queuing systems of the type exemplified in Beckett's 1981 television play, first broadcast in Germany, in fact. Beckett Grey Codes are designed... Beckett is not usually theorized as a practitioner concerned with the practices or implications of digitality or even of technology, although he produced work for radio, film, and television that engaged with the specificities of those media. However, if one takes concepts and practices of quantification, computation, and their application to social life as formations that exist beyond computing machines, and if one takes these extensions as indices of broader historical forces that shape, as well as being shaped by, computing machines, one realizes that Beckett had been engaging with digitality from his earliest prose works. So this passage from What, which Beckett began writing in 1942, it's his second novel, is exemplary of the author's persistent interest in algorithmic logic as it functions quite separately from computing machines. Mrs. Gorman called every Thursday, except when she was indisposed. Then she did not call, but stayed at home, in bed or in a comfortable chair, before the fire if the weather was cold, and by the open window if the weather was warm, and if the weather was neither cold nor warm, by the closed window or before the empty hearth. And essentially the entire novel, it's about a 300-page novel, is composed of these kind of branching logical possibilities. To exemplify the computational character of this text, in his 1987 book, The Mechanic Muse, the literary critic Hugh Kenner reformulated this passage, first in the programming language Pascal, and then as a natural language algorithm. This is actually kind of extraordinary that this work was happening in the 1980s, given how we normally periodize kind of digital humanities methods. So this is that the Mrs. Gorman passage in Pascal, and then in a kind of natural language algorithm. This specific intersection between the concerns of computational logic and the concerns of aesthetic production that may not directly represent computing machines or computer use foregrounds what strikes me as an essential methodology for the analysis of contemporary culture. That a problem which appears in the work of a mid-century novelist and playwright can be considered a problem of computation in a very formal way, as in the Beckett Grey Code, points towards the complex relationship between digital culture and the dominant notion of the social that is the primary concern of this exhibition. So to count as a Beckett Grey Code, a sequence of numbers must meet, or a sequence must meet the following conditions. So all possible combinations are represented once, each change of state must involve the entry or exit of a single bit or object or actor, and then thirdly, the departures of the various players must follow a first-in, last-out logic. And so here is the script of Quod, the play, the television play from which the Beckett Grey Code was, I took inspiration, I guess. And so you can see the structure of it. It's kind of straightforward. There's a square stage. The four corners are numbered A, B, C, D. There are four players, and each player has a course of actions. And their course of actions are basically diagrammed directly below the square. So the idea is if they simply follow the instructions, they're enacting the play. And this is also in the script. It's this diagram of the directions of movement that are produced by this kind of algorithmic script. So to make this more concrete, I'm just going to play. So Beckett, when he was making the notes, when he was devising the script for Quod, calculated it as taking about 24 minutes to run. to execute, if you like, by these four players. But when it's actually been performed, it tends to be about 9 minutes long. So there's this enormous gulf between Beckett's projected timing of the piece and the time it takes to actually perform. So I'm going to show about a five-minute clip of it. This is from a TV broadcast in the early 1980s. On the one hand, the piece produces something like an intensified version of Taylorist work discipline. It calls to mind the computer-aided efficiency of the Amazon Fulfillment Center, this is what the Amazon warehouses are called, in which workers are guided to the next collection by software that combines a route-finding application and an extremely strict timer, software that, like the supply chains of such companies as Amazon, and like the logic of capital itself, appears to work on the principle that the worker and the items with which they must interact are virtual objects or symbols in a system of pure logic, not subject to fatigue. But two things are especially interesting to me about this piece, Quad, in relation to the computational logic that the Beckett-Gray code emphasizes. So firstly, while gray code has been mapped for 2, 5, 6, 7, and 8 objects, codes for 3 and 4 objects have yet to be found. In other words, the aesthetic work that provides the inspiration and the name for Beckett-Gray code cannot be modeled in Beckett-Gray code. Secondly, while the entry, exit, and movement patterns of the four actors can be reduced to an algorithm, to these courses of A, C, C, B, B, A, and so on, the physical presence of the bodies reproduces a problem that cannot be rendered algorithmically and to which the script of the play only vaguely gestures, the problem of what the actors do when they encounter each other and the center of the square. And so the idea is that they never break stride, that every single crossing takes exactly the same amount of time and they maintain an even pace. So this is from the very end of the script, a note, problem, negotiation of E without rupture of rhythm when 3 or 4 players cross paths at this point, or if rupture is accepted, how to best exploit. I like how the question of how to best exploit is kept open, even though this problem basically can't be reduced to the script form of the piece. So the play intersects with and exemplifies both the abstract ideal of computable human activity and the impossibility of fully tallying this computability to concrete reality. In the light of the Beckett-Gray code, the failures of algorithmic representation presented in Quad make me think of Friedrich Kittler's mantra, I'm going to kind of paraphrase it, in the age of digital signal processing, only that which can be represented as a switching circuit is at all. I'm especially interested in the status of that which, by not being representable as a switching circuit, does not exist from the point of view of media systems such as capitalism. I'm also interested in the historical specificity of the points of view from which conditions of existent and non-existent are determined. As the nervous system exhibition shows, there's a close relationship between computation and the imagination, modeling, and management of the social. Because of this, the status of what, and more importantly, who, it gets left out or suspended from these imaginaries, models, and management systems seems to be of primary importance today. So to return to the questions I raised at the outset of this talk, I'm interested in the ways in which we might be able to understand the relationship between inclusion and occlusion in interconnected systems of computation and capitalist accumulation. Because, as Kittler's mantra implies, that which is not included in a system of computation is not negligible or non-existent. Rather, it is a precondition for that system. Just as the logical form of software is only executable in hardware, making hardware-optimizing coding systems such as gray code necessary, the coded movements that from one point of view make up the totality of Beckett's quad are only executable because there are material bodies through which they can be executed. And these bodies have access to a wider range of movements and non-movements from which they can select. Equally, even when following their coded schemas, A, C, C, B, and so on, the possibility of deviation is what makes the coded path thinkable, and most critically, is what makes code executable. The relationship between what is representable and thus valorizable through a system of computation is also shown here to be plastic rather than fixed. The problem of how to best exploit the interruptions imposed by the sensor is kept open in the script. This relationship between excluded deviations and their centrality to a given system is phrased beautifully by Michel Serre when he writes in The Parasite that difference is part of the thing itself and perhaps even produces the thing. Maybe the radical origin of things is really that difference, even though classical rationalism damned it to hell. In the beginning was the noise. In Marx, this question of the outside that makes the system possible is explicitly connected to the production and management of surplus populations, or those deemed unproductive and thus excluded from relations of exchange. So Marx writes, the surplus population becomes the lever of capitalistic accumulation, nay, a condition of its existence of the capitalist mode of production. It forms a disposable industrial reserve army that belongs to capital quite as absolutely as if the latter had bred it at its own cost. Independently of the limits of the actual increase of population, it creates, for the changing needs of the self-expansion of capital, a mass of human activity, mass of human material, always ready for exploitation. This constitutive function of excluded bodies has been taken up by a number of later Marxian thinkers. Rosa Luxemburg phrases the problem in these terms: capitalism in its full maturity depends in all respects on non-capitalist strata and social organizations existing side by side with it. While more recently, the Endnotes Collective writes that there must be an exterior to value in order for value to exist. Similarly, for labor to exist and to serve as the measure of value, there must be an exterior to labor. The constitutive exclusion takes a number of forms in relation to capitalist accumulation. There is, of course, that which is left out by the compression of lived life or human activity into the specific form of labor that produces surplus value, the same compression that renders the worker dot-like, in Marx's words. But there's also the colonization of land, bodies, and minds so that new raw materials and new spaces for expansion can be added to existing networks. There is the objectification of people into saleable commodities in the form of slavery and the growing sectors of private incarceration and institutionalization that are somehow grouped under the category of service industries. There are the range of so-called unproductive forms of labor that are required to reproduce the ostensibly productive workforce, from childbirth and childcare to cooking, cleaning, and other forms of care work. So while it's important to think through the ways in which digital technologies for the quantification of social activity intensify and even mutate the fundamental protocols of accumulation, it's also important to think through the ways in which forms of life that remain unquantified make these protocols possible, as well as the forms of violence that persist around the boundary between the two. Another passage from Frederick Douglass makes clear the ways in which these unquantified but essential activities or bodies often agglomerate in ways that emphasize the raced and gendered violence of capital. If any one thing in my experience more than another served to deepen my conviction that in the infernal character of slavery and to fill me with unutterable loathing of slaveholders, it was their base ingratitude to my poor old grandmother. She had served my old master faithfully from youth to old age. She had been the source of all his wealth. She had peopled his plantation with slaves. She had become a great-grandmother in his service. She had rocked him in infancy, attended him in childhood, served him through life, and at his death wiped from his icy brow the cold death sweat. She was nevertheless left a slave for life, a slave in the hands of strangers, and in their hands she saw her children, her grandchildren, and her great-grandchildren divided like so many sheep, without being gratified with the small privilege of a single word as to their or her own destiny. So when we think about quantification, digitality, and sociality, and when we think about the ways in which contemporary art engages with, represents, and critiques the intersections of these terms, we might also think about the stakes of quantification, the structural impossibility of full inclusion that grounds both digital mediation and capital, the protocols through which conditions of representability, computability, and inclusion are decided upon and allocated, and the longer histories of race and gendered exclusion and suspension upon which the so-called information age is premised. Thanks.
So thank you, Seb Franklin. That was fantastic. So I think what we're going to do is a, like, because we don't, how much time do we actually have now for the discussion? 40 minutes. Okay, that's quite good. So what we're going to do is start with a discussion between Seb Franklin and Ana Tijero Pinto, and then we're going to open that up to a sort of targeted, quantifiable audience of people that have been involved with the exhibition or have provided triangulations, and or the other speakers, and then we'll open that up a little bit later to the public. So, yeah. Well, I think what I would like to sort of ask for the two of you in the, to start with is, in a way, you're looking at different, very specific histories of how quantification has come into play, and I think especially how, in a way, there's an assumption that the neoliberal agenda has replaced something like capitalism, or it's understood to not have an ideological approach. It's just as if it would be natural, and that's the biology behind these, a lot of the digital networks that we work with. So one thing is the assumed depoliticization of these networks and the assumed lack of an ideology there. And in a way, both of you address those, how those things have sort of been systematized, but also then become things that we don't have to question it. So, and I think the exhibition really tries to question that. So I would ask both of you to maybe respond on each other's riffs. Is that a starting point?
Do you want to go ahead?
Yep. No, okay. Well, to respond directly, I would say that the way cybernetics addresses it quite subtly, because basically it integrates. You know, like, imagine, think about how it begins. No, it begins with an attempt to shoot down an enemy fighter. No, you have a plane. Plane is flying towards you. And is this on? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you are trying to predict where the plane is going to be next, because of course it's like shooting a fly. Sorry, shooting. You don't shoot flies. it's like attempting to kill a fly. You know, you cannot hit the spot where the fly is because it will be somewhere else next. So you have to predict where the fly is going to be, and you know, like, you take your best shot, and you know, it's just, we might be successful and kill the fly. But what Wiener realized is that the differential analyzer could actually process all the pattern or all the flight pattern of the pilot and give you a result that would operate below the threshold of human consciousness, meaning it would seem to be done in negative time, like you'd seemingly have the result before the pilot reached that point and you could shoot him down. But what this process implies is that both the pilot and the gun that is trying to kill the pilot are part of an integrated equation. So when you think, what is the analogy that emerges? Like, it's clearly like the same, you know, it's clearly like operating on the same rhetorical level as the description of like free market interaction. Know that you have like being reiterated throughout the last 200 years of history, and actually there's a wonderful book about this. Written by Otto Mayer, the usage of the government, the governor in Watt's steam engine, and all the subsequent history of servo mechanisms was always used rhetorically to discuss or to explain, like, the self-regulating political system. So basically, supply and demand, or like emergent order, or yeah. Mm-hmm.
And just to pick up on those examples of very early kind of cybernetic prediction exercises and how they kind of produce a kind of a vocabulary or even a conceptual framework for a much wider set of practices, I mean, those very particular examples, those experiments, there are very clear disclaimers in the descriptions of them and in the accounts of them by Wiener and by Claude Chen and others that they only work in extremely specific, constrained circumstances. So the anti-aircraft predictor can only theoretically work, you know, when you take into account the pilot is flying an aeroplane that has only very specific possibilities for movement. It has to obey the laws of physics.
For possible, you know,
yeah, movement. Right, so they're all in these earliest experiments in prediction or in the kind of modeling of self-regulation, they're always so constrained. And what you see over the middle decades of the 20th century is the dream of prediction and the dream of a kind of a modelable, fully self-regulating economy drives this kind of disappearance of all of the constraints. So people just love the idea of predictability and just forget about the fact that it only really works in specific circumstances. And that's when you start to see cybernetic theory emerge into like management theory, supply chain theory, economics. I mean, neoclassical economics. Philip Mirofsky has this extraordinary kind of history of the conceptual exchanges, or even, you know, unidirectional conceptual movement of ideas from cybernetics and information theory into kind of Chicago-style economic theory.
Just to add, this was not devoid of polemics, because in the first Macy conferences, of course, there were competing models for like information exchange. And for instance, Donald McKay, he wanted, you know, like this. There is something that is really interesting that Shannon does when he says there's a distinction in between message and signal, because he says, okay, what you transmit is the signal. The message you only have if you decode the signal successfully. So basically, information is predicated on the exact reproduction or replication of a signal. And there is something inherently conservative about the schema. And McKay, for instance, he said that for him, information would be something that would only be instantiated if it would cause a change in the state of the receiver. So basically, you know, like, there would only be successful information transfer if this message that was transmitted would cause the receiver to shift its position or its state. But of course, this would imply that you would have to quantify the state, which would be like subjective, right? Because you'd have to take into consideration what's the state of the receiver, and you know, like, how can you quantify it into a model or into a mathematical model? So this was abandoned. But there was another objection also from Lawrence Kubi, who was like trained in psychoanalysis, and he said that they were also not taking into account that every message is doubly encoded. So basically it says something about the world, but it also reflexively says something about the speaker. So, you know, like, it always has this double potentiality. And this was also something, you know, like, it was another path that it wasn't pursued. And so this is to say, there is really no absolute necessity about the way that this, all this multidimensional field kind of emerged and then, like, somehow crystallized itself. Right. So
maybe I would just ask you to, when you say it wasn't followed up on, do you know a little bit more about why? And for example, like, why one particular model took over the others and the others were dismissed?
Well, I mean, several reasons. No, one is that it's obvious because it's very difficult to quantify subjective states. No, like, I mean, you don't have a way to. And the other, which is, maybe a little subjective also, is that there was like a deep, seated resistance towards anything that had something to do with psychoanalysis. And this is also why I started with behaviorism, because it's precisely behaviorism that imposes this model of a psychology that is completely devoid of subjectivity, and then you just simply don't want to go there. And for instance, McCulloch, who developed the first model for neural networks, he, after the war, actively raided against... He actively campaigned against the returning soldiers being treated by psychoanalysis. At the time, it was not common to have like a trauma treated by psychopharmaca, but he thought that psychopharmaca would be the way, you know, like, to just inhibit the serotonin receptors and to, you know, like, rebalance. So basically, the idea is that the brain functions a little bit like a servo mechanism or this kind of homeostatic system, where you just have to rebalance, you know, like, the system, and then everything would be okay. And all this idea of, like, mental states or interiority are simply not being considered.
Mm. And this is actually one of the places in, if you look in the kind of archive of cybernetic theory, where you can most clearly see that the methodology is premised on exclusion, not on integration. So in William Ross Ashby's Design for a Brain, he's talking about, you know, how can you model a brain in electronic components? And he says, well, you know, you can kind of do it pretty accurately as long as you just don't include any of the things that you can't count. And his main the example he gives is consciousness. So he's like, oh, yeah.
So one thing that kind of interests me is that, like, there, in a way, two others, like, another line of cybernetics would be the socialist cybernetics, early Soviet models, as, like, voiced in, like, Bogdanov's red star, and as you could have seen in Chile in cyber with the Cyber Sin project, which interestingly gets overrun by the Chicago School, like neoliberal economic policies. But what role do you see that the Macy Congresses took place in this very specific context of American post-war McCarthyism as well? And that how did that influence those results? Or how would you say that influenced those results, which is in a way like sort of locating that then with not just the neoliberal sort of plot, but an anti-communist plot as well?
Well, I think the entire MIT maths department were investigated by the HUAC, right, in 50 or 51.
Yeah, I mean, okay, it's the story is very differentiated. You cannot just like, there's a lot of nuance, no? Like, of course, like a lot of people involved in the Macy conferences, they were communists or communist sympathizers. I think that... it's also true that a lot of like the war, you know, like they were getting military funding, all of them. So I mean, okay, but I don't know if we should now like go into the intrinsicities of all this process. I think that the CyberSyn project, which would have the potential to develop into like an amazing model of like how do you call it, self-governance. Mm-hmm. Was never instantiated, no, because mostly because they didn't have the technology. ARPANET was only coming into being in '69, and they, you know, like were working in the early '70s.
So Vina, in the cybernetics book, and also in a lot of his unpublished writings, diaries, letters, he makes these kind of remarkably similar claims. Which at one level seem to be these kind of overt anti-capitalist sentiments. So he talks about doing away with the culture of buying and selling, and you know this is the only way we're going to be able to have a functional society. But interestingly, he doesn't really seem to care about the underlying dynamics that make such a society problematic. So his motivation is it's the only way you can have a fully homeostatic society, or the only way in which you can have a society in which information flows fully and freely between every node is if there are no kind of private interests in the media. So it's this very kind of media network-centric vision of a kind of egalitarian society or something. And he wrote a lot about factory automation and unemployment as well. But again, every time it's very frustrating because every time you think that you're going to find this moment at which he reveals a kind of a Marxian analysis, actually it turns out that he's just talking in these abstract terms about like, well, how can we imagine social life as a network? And all of these things are kind of getting in the way, so we have to get rid of them. I mean, ironically, it turned out that exact network imaginary that he wanted to see installed so purely actually turned out to be the kind of imaginary of neoclassical economics, neoliberalism, what gets called neoliberalism.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I think that there's like this structurally the theory like has it as it came into being has a fundamentally conservative bias because of course like if you're always privileging this moment of homeostasis, no, like basically any disturbance is a deviation and needs to be corrected and it will be you know like the system will try to rebalance itself. The system will try to you know again find its like point of equilibrium. And this is, of course, like a metaphor that is already very, you know, it was very familiar already at the time. But which doesn't mean, I mean, I would just like to qualify this because I think that, you know, this is exactly the same type of technocracy that you find in operation in the Soviet Union at the time. It's not exactly as if they are working on completely different models. No, like, I mean, they mirror each other, actually. Though they don't have a market.
Yeah.
You can kind of see why Friedrich Hayek expressed a real enthusiasm for certain sub-areas of cybernetics that he became aware of because, you know, Hayek, Margaret Thatcher's favorite philosopher, and he wrote in the early 1940s about the price, you know, this is basically the neoclassical Econ kind of 101, really, you know, that the market itself is a kind of system of information processing that can yield the only sufficient level of data to make social management possible. You know, so you have to get rid of states and just have markets instead because they're the only thing that can kind of allow a state to self-regulate.
I wanted to ask you something about then representational aesthetics, because this was, and maybe you could go into that, because one thing is, like, you mentioned that sort of in the context of an exhibition, but I think when you talk about representation, like, there are different layers of, as I understood it, there are different layers of the representation that you're talking about, and maybe could you expand on that?
Sure. I mean, I'm really interested in, and I haven't, it's not something I've really written about as a central topic, but I think I will, because there's a question of representation in the form of like a computer model, right, of a simulation. And then there are questions that are more familiar to humanities scholars of representation, but I don't know of them having been written of or thought about together. Now, of course, then it becomes incredibly interesting that, so in the discussion that I briefly touched upon from the sixth Macy, when von Neumann is basically saying, oh, well, you know, the digital is actually just a descriptive regime, right? There is no naturally occurring kind of digital phenomena. There are just continuous phenomena that humans understand as discontinuous. He uses representation throughout those comments, and of course these are transcribed conversations, so we can't guarantee that he's being like super precise with his language, but nonetheless there's a whole interesting set of kind of slippages there. He talks about conceptualization and representation as basically being the same, and as basically both being kind of digital processes, like human cognitive processes.
Oh, okay, I would add that already this description, you know, when you have a nervous system or a nerve cell, which can only do two things, which is fire or inhibit a signal, and then you have an electric circuit, which is on-off, and then you have logical propositions, which can be true or false, and you just like somehow conflate them all together and say, okay, like there's an absolute identity that's at play here. This is the aesthetics, you know, like I think that this is like the core, or the, let's say, the crux of digital aesthetics, or the aesthetics of the digital domain.
Okay, maybe, do you have, I mean, that's, I think that's a good sort of summing up of, I think, what should be a book. Next. Did you, either of you have questions for each other that you want to pose? Then we do that. I wanted to ask Steph and Mark and maybe Anzum if they wanted to come with it, if you have questions. And do we have a microphone? I'm sure we have a microphone. If you can, yeah. Yes. Okay. Did you want to? I don't know, if you don't want to say anything, maybe we open it up. And if you have a question, please wave your hand. Okay, Jan is. Jan's up here in the front. Can we? Is that a question in the back, or are you just taking pictures? Okay, the man in the back wins the last bid.
One question to you, to Hayek, because Hayek himself was a neuroscientist before he became an economist. Yeah. Like, could he specify what his take was on cybernetics? Because, if I remember it right, he was particularly interested in neural networks, of course.
Yeah. So there's really nothing in writing. I mean, obviously there's this earlier paper from the early 40s, The Use of Information in Society, which is the one when he sets out this kind of communications network concept of the market as a kind of ideal governor, if you like. But everything else you have to kind of reconstruct from, you know, the odd comment here or reference here. I mean, I know that he met and spoke with von Neumann, and he was particularly interested in the late work that von Neumann was doing when he died on cellular automata. And I guess that he saw it primarily as informing his kind of work on the mind. But at the same time, we have to see all of these kind of conceptual movements between the two. I mean, this is what, in a sense, cybernetics mobilizes, is this whole set of conceptual exchanges between between the neural net and the market. So it's something you have to kind of put together. A few people have written on it. There's some stuff in the Mirovsky book about their meetings and encounters. I think they exchanged a couple of letters.
I think that I wasn't addressed, but I'm going to answer nonetheless. if I remember it correctly. You know, because there's a slight difference in Wiener uses information as the opposite of entropy, but Claude Shannon says that entropy can also be considered information. So basically, a disruption to the system can be reintegrated into the system at the, you know, like when it reorganizes itself at a higher level of complexity. And this is precisely the take that, you know, like this is IX take. And this is also like, I think, and I'm speculating because I didn't really research on that, but I think this has a lot to do with this idea of creative disruption, you know, like the how the digital economy narrates its innovations as creative disruption.
Is that good? Could you, can we put the microphone to this gentleman in the middle here? Is that, do you have the mic, Jan? Ah, okay, then just there. Can you raise your hand a little bit? Yeah.
Kind of for both of you, but it seems like more in your analysis, Seb, the question of failure and then what you called exclusion kind of shows up, and the problem of how, you know, all the systems end up looking first order when you expand. But I'm wondering about like what the contemporary stakes are of this, you know, like kind of second phase of the of what was already like a retro looking back on cybernetics and systems when it's started a few years ago, where like it seems like that, you know, in all of this there's this kind of like a neo-Sansimonian invocation of like anti politics and like a, you know, this non-ideology, but it seems like always this was always working much more as a ideological project, as a cultural project, as kind of like pop science in technology that's not like science. It's the American kind of military defense industry, which is, you know, using it to fight the you know the Cold War, but then it's basically like you know these are the people who like lost the Vietnam War, you know, completely failed at like urban planning in the 70s, reused the old like the you know the counterinsurgency doctrine in Afghanistan, failed again, like even missed the breakdown of the Soviet Union, all this like never worked to actually predict anything outside of these like neatly marked off kind of fields where they could basically set the rules up and then, you know, congratulate themselves for predicting how the system would, mm-hmm. would kind of run. And even now, like Amazon, like it does, well, what Amazon does really well, but it doesn't really, you know, like never gives me any books which I want to read, you know, like, and so I'm wondering like why this weird kind of like idiosyncratic marginal discourse is now again being received, and I worry in this kind of like uncritical way where people say, oh, this is neuroscience, or this is like, you know, this is information theory, when it was there's really kind of this boutique, you know, like thing.
Yeah. I mean, this is a great question. So a book, I don't know if it came out here, but a book, kind of a pop literary criticism book came out, I think, maybe last year, in the UK on understanding Jane Austen using game theory. yeah, you're right. I mean, there is this. And I think neurolinguistic programming is one of the most interesting of those kind of pop scientific kind of discursive dispersals. And the interest in it is also like a super interesting symptom of something. So actually Gregory Bateson, who is at the Macy conferences from the beginning, even from before, he wrote the foreword to the first book by the two people that kind of invented neurolinguistic programming in Palo Alto. So it's one of these ways in which you can actually see a direct line from cybernetics, even through the people involved, into this kind of pop science business kind of assemblage. The first part of your question is interesting because I get asked this all the time, actually. What about second order cybernetics? I mean, what's interesting is, and it gets at something kind of that's a compelling historical pointer, I think, which is that, you know, modern kind of orthodox economic theory, management theory, supply chain management, and so on, they all look like cybernetics, but they look like first order cybernetics, and no one cares about second order cybernetics at all. So the word cybernetics disappears, and a certain set of claims, because of their kind of congeniality to capital, actually, seem to kind of provide the epistemic grounding for a whole set of shifts, I guess, after or during the long 70s.
I think we're going to go quickly to Mo. Is that?
Can I
Okay, let Anna.
I just wanted to make a little comment. I wouldn't put it quite that way, because I think that cybernetics succeeded in an astonishing way. You know, like, of course, it all boils down to how you define it, because of course cybernetics was. Well, it was a science, meaning it was, of course, emerging out of the field of engineering, and it was applying statistics to engineering, to electrical engineering. Okay, this is the strict definition or the technical definition. Then it became some sort of like multidimensional rhetoric strategy. You know? Like, so all these fields start to coalesce around it. Some of these fields are incredibly successful. Molecular biology, for instance, like neurophysiology, neuropsychology. I mean, like this. Everything that we do nowadays is completely, it was completely shaped in those days, like during the 40s and the 50s. So maybe I understood you incorrectly, because I don't think that it just created some sort of like pop science or some sort of like pop culture phenomena, or it's just a body of metaphors. No, like, I mean, this is actually it's the scientific conceptual framework that actually shapes how our life is organized.
Just one more thing before I forget, because I've just remembered this, and it's another kind of amazingly interesting tidbit. So I was about kind of symptomatic movements between cybernetics and certain versions of historically interesting pop science. I was in the Claude Shannon archives at the Library of Congress last summer, and there's a letter from L. Ron Hubbard to Claude Shannon, and it's obviously part of a longer exchange of the rest of which is missing from that archive. And obviously Shannon, and they may have just been trying to kind of get rid of him or fob him off, but Shannon and I think Warren McCulloch as well were kind of, you know, approving of Dianetics as Hubbard was describing it to them at this point. They seem to think of it as like a totally cognate discipline with the kinds of models that they were working with. I mean, it might have just been that they were all against psychoanalysis, and so that's where the alliance was, but it's interesting still.
Okay, we're going to go down here, and then we've got Jan. And so, yeah.
Hello. You know, before I bring up two things, you know, you read a series of quotes that sort of like framed this idea that was like central to your paper, which was sort of like these systems function by exclusion of certain elements. And this sort of like belongs to the same trajectory, and it's by Cornelius Castoriadis, writing in the 60s, saying, reification, the essential tendency of capitalism, can never be wholly realized. If the system were actually able to change individuals into things moved only by economic forces, it would collapse not in the long run, but immediately. The struggle of people against reification is just as much as a tendency towards reification, the condition for the functioning of capitalism. Capitalism can function only by continually drawing upon the genuinely human activity of those subject to it, while at the same time trying to level and dehumanize them as much as possible. So the flip side of the argument is that, you know, I mean, we can concentrate on the limitations of the cybernetic first order or second order, and how they try to like sort of like collapse the complexity of sort of like the world into a binary system. But what's important here is the success of this type of force in order to produce a particular type of future, right? And I think what we ourselves share with this paradigm is just thinking of our work as a form of reflection, which itself in a temporal sequence, it's after the fact, right? Reflection, critique. Even sort of like a simple negation, right? Rather than looking at it already as a form of intervention that's trying to produce a kind of future. Mm-hmm. So I think that's sort of like the weakness that some of us see sort of like addressed by newer types of ideas and philosophies that tries to sort of like reverse this without necessarily rejecting all the sort of like legacies of cybernetics. And a question for us, I think, is a good place to ask this question is like Anna was saying, right in the beginning with the Macy conferences, they decided to exclude psychoanalysis as a form of like wishy-washy qualitative thing that doesn't like have any place in this. But we on the humanities side ourselves are guilty of neglecting cybernetics for a long time. I mean, how long does it take for a book like Catherine Hill's How We Became Posthuman to come out, 1999. So now it's 2016, and we're still sort of like trying to digest this stuff, like, you know what I mean, like 14, 15 years later, right? So we are also guilty of kind of like doing the same thing that they did to qualitative and humanities. And now we're kind of like a little bit late, and we have a lot of catching up to do.
Yeah, beautifully put. I agree.
Can I ask you something? Is it basically, like, I would say that it looks like you're also saying that how do you bring back in the sort of dynamics of race, class, and gender and make us, like, cybernetic models that include those which were excluded? Just, yeah, that's, okay, we're clear, good. Jan?
I would like to add something to the question we had before about the popularity of pop science. I thought, because also Anna quoted it, like, Jonathan Crary's idea about the screen as a tracking device is built on De Boer's and like Foucault's idea of the panopticon and the spectacle. I think she also mentioned it. I think what we have there as a phenomenon, on like I think also what we see right now with accelerationism and that interest in cybernetics has to do exactly with this coupling of spectacle and control. Because what we see there is not only control, but we also see the spectacle of control. And this is fascinating as a truth effect. And this is what we are witnessing here, like as this is also a pop science event somehow. And I think this is kind of this fascination like we are dealing here with.
Yeah, great.
Yes.
I think we're going to go there to Pod, and then afterwards to Christopher Gunzing with the microphone. So, did you want to answer, Jan? Did you want to respond to that?
I think it's okay if other people get to talk. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the success that we see right now of cybernetic management, we could almost say it's successful in a kind of coming ecocide. An ecocidal impact and a techno-industrial fascism. And I'm just curious because the hackers bring into the conversation the cyber sin model, and I don't know too much about that, but I tend to think that it's a bit still technotopian to bring this back into the conversation, because if you're managing life systems, ecosystems with cybernetics, you're still going to have something that's potentially techno-industrial fascism. Mm-hmm. So is the cyber sin model really worth trying to bring back as a positive thing under something other than capitalism?
Well, it's
in microphone.
Microphone. It's Tuber now. But of course, that was not what was intended originally. No, like I mean, basically, like technically speaking, it's in existence. Like no, there's like now a lot of like a lot of the digital economy operates precisely in those terms. Whether this cyber scene would ever have developed into a social utopia, we will not know because it was not attempted. I think that, of course, if you think about the potential of the technology, I would say that yes, definitely, it has an immense potential. Of course, like you know, like any other technology, you have to politicize it. And again, it's not enough to say, "Oh, we are just going to use it in you know, like because technology never has a virgin birth. No, like it's always coming into being into a world that is already predetermined by certain structural conditions. So that's why I was pointing to this moment where you actually discuss how to formulate information and theory. You know, because it's precisely at this inception that certain tendencies get crystallized. So, of course, you know, like if you want to really like determine the usages of a technology, you cannot do it when it's already completely like, you know, when it's already formalized. You have to do it, you know, like, how you say, beforehand. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, like you have to do it, you have to create it anew.
Hmm. I think
but if you're saying that's already in play.
Paul, I'm so sorry, but we really don't have time for this kind of back and forth. I think we're going to move on to Christopher, because this is, I think you are clear, it's a part of the development process and not the implementation. Right? But I think we got to move to Christopher Ganzing now. He has black shirt back there, microphone.
Sorry, I'll come in with an even longer two comments, questions. First, I want to go back to the very first point of discussion, which was about, I think, the idea of like detecting a difference at the receiver point in the system, which I think Anna dismissed as some kind of dream of being able to quantify subjective. Subject state of like reception from a subjective point of view. But I think, isn't that exactly what we have today, though? I'm not so sure that what they were striving at was really like detecting somehow changes in consciousness, but rather perhaps would depend on what definition you would have of the end user and what we're seeing today in all this, I mean, in all our social networks that are being data mined and so on is, of course, an abstracted subject, a datafied subject. So I'm wondering if that's actually not something that cybernetics has been able to pursue further and to a much more advanced state, if you will, today. Then the other question, a little bit more complex, is about temporality and the idea of teleological mechanisms, which I think is an extremely like telling description of even perhaps the very motivation behind establishing cybernetics as a kind of a historic scientific tradition, if you will, so coming out of a post-World War II situation where the past, present, and future is not teleology in the sense of Hegel or something. It's like a very kind of closed feedback loop in itself, and I would like if any of you could comment on that a little bit further. I mean, teleological mechanism was kind of, this term was launched, I think, at the same time as also Orwell wrote 1984. It's in the year 1948 that Wiener publishes his first book. And a very kind of telling quote from that book, I think, is from Wiener, to carry out, or if it's a later one, I can't remember now, to predict the future is to carry out an operation on the past. And of course we have Orwell's famous sentence that he who controls the past controls the future, and he who controls the present controls the past. And there is all these kind of ideas that come out of cybernetics on the control society, and we tend to think of it as kind of foreboding surveillance and control, but I think the greatest, perhaps, control of cybernetics has been carried on our very ideas of temporality, reducing the past to data, and kind of doing away with history. And so, yeah, these are my two.
You were obviously not here when I spoke, right?
No, no, but you spoke more about the conflation on nature technology in a way than on this particular aspect. So I will be,
exactly,
yeah, just curious. It's not a critique, I just want to know more.
You know, like that precisely the model that you modeled, you know, like you study the past behavior. You study the past behavior of the organism in order to predict its future behavior. So, of course, and clearly, the model of temporality, it's progress. The model of temporality, it's clearly irreversible. No, it follows a time arrow, but it's not progressive in a political sense. And of course, like the past always emerges as this kind of like standing reserve of information that you can just mine, and this is precisely what happens now. You know, like every time you log in, like all your, you know, like all of your past interactions are being mined in order to feed you with, you know, like this curated browsing that would, you know, like direct your online navigation, and of course. But I don't even think, you know, like, I don't think that's the question. I think the question is, like, how, because, for instance, when you think about how is this implemented at usage in a political sense, when you have, for instance, like, these kill lists or these attacks in Pakistan that just, like, in Pakistan where a drone just, like, happens to kill an entire wedding ceremony, the problem is not exactly the technology. The problem is, like, for instance, how this metaphor of the swarm, or, you know, like the this other always appearing as some sort of like undifferentiated entity, you know, like that never has an individuality, also infects the usage of the technology, you know, because it's precisely this that is in operation there, that you just think, oh, it's totally fine to shoot a drone into a wedding party because, you know, like they are not people, no, like they are this kind of like undifferentiated collective. And if you just so happen to kill 200, it's collateral. I don't know if this was what you were...
And just quickly on the first point, I think that's right. And you can kind of see this in the infrastructure of what we could call, I guess, the, you know, Web 2.0 economy or something, right? That the difference that's registered, the only difference that matters registered at the part of the receiver is some kind of action, like a click. So it's not enough to see a spectacle and be moved by it somehow. The only movement that counts as a movement is if you respond to it in some kind of measurable form mediated by hardware.
Okay, unfortunately, we're going to use the hardware to mediate the close of this discussion right now. So thank you both, Seb Franklin and Ana Tijera Pinto. We're going to take a half-hour break, and then we can, if you like, to come in out of the sun, join us for Yevgeny Morozov, Laboria Kobonics, and Franco Berardi-Bifo. So thanks so much.